It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, NPR's Paula Poundstone will be in Green Bay this weekend. We'll talk to her about life in the funny lane.
First, the battle over transportation continues on here in Wisconsin. With delays coming for some of the biggest highway construction projects in the state, Governor Scott Walker's administration is calling on the state legislature to approve $200 million in new borrowing this year to keep those projects on schedule.
But it appears that not all Republicans are on board with that plan. Some are expressing skepticism over the prospect of more borrowing, meaning Democratic votes might be needed to get the plan passed.
Here with us now to take a look at the roads funding picture is Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So $200 million this year in borrowing for roads projects, that's what Governor Walker's asking for. What would that money be used for?
That is supposed to set five major projects that have already been delayed a little closer to schedule. These projects would still be delayed, but if they get this money and a supplemental borrowing in the next fiscal year as well, then instead of a two-year delay, we would have a one-year delay.
Now, it's a little weird. This money is sort of pre-approved, but the governor has to get the legislature to tap into it. Is that right?
That's right. So they had a huge fight in the budget. Republicans control everything in state government, but they disagreed over how to do highway funding. Money's not keeping up from the gas tax with the construction plans that the DOT has. Walker wanted to borrow $1.3 billion, which would have been a record amount. Republicans in the legislature said that's too much. Scaled it back to $500 million that the administration would automatically get, and then held another $350 million in reserve, saying that if the administration asked for it and specified which projects would benefit from it, then the budget committee for the legislature could release that money. And now the Walker administration wants $200 million, sort of its first piece of that additional money, and Republicans in the legislature are split as to whether to let it go.
Yeah, let's talk about that response from Republicans in particular. Some key players lining up on both sides of this, it looks like.
Yeah, so it's split among Republicans. It seems to be pretty cleanly split between the Senate and the Assembly. One of the fights as they decided how much to borrow for roads was the zoo interchange in southeastern Wisconsin, a major project. All the Republicans there said they needed to make sure to keep that on track. The outstate Republicans said, we understand that's an important project, but we don't want to be faced with all of these delays. So they came up with this compromise. The Assembly Republicans felt like they thought there was a pretty clear deal that they would eventually get this money. Now Senate Republicans are saying, we're not sure we want to put that money out because this would affect other funding. The state would have to pay this back, and that might interfere with getting enough money for schools as well as for roads.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about transportation funding and a request from the governor for borrowing a couple hundred million this year, $150 million, I believe, next year to get some stalled road projects back into action. So one thought is, since some Republicans are for it, some are against it, this could get passed with a coalition, if you will, between some Republicans and some Democrats who support these projects. Is that a likely outcome?
The Democrats will likely be decisive in this, and they're usually frozen out of sort of major decisions because they're in the minority in both houses. With Republican split on the Joint Finance Committee, there's just four Democrats on that 16-member committee, but their votes would be crucial in getting this passed unless Senate Republicans start changing their mind.
So when would this money kick in, assuming it gets approved? When would road projects start up, or have they really still been going and the delay hasn't started yet?
Yeah, so I believe all of the projects are underway. There might be one or two that aren't, but effectively, these are projects that take multiple years. We're talking about like the expansion of I-39 from the state line to Madison. That's two lanes in both directions now. It expanded to three lanes in both directions. So that's going to take many years to do. They've started the initial work on that. The delays don't mean anything stops. It just means that instead of being, say, a six-year project, it's going to be an eight-year project. So if they can, if they approve that this fall yet, the bids can be let for next spring, and the work, they can do a little bit of catch-up. But again, even if they get all of this additional bonding that they want, these five projects are still going to be delayed by a year. It's just that the alternative would be a two-year delay.
at the core of this long-running debate over transportation funding is the idea that, gas is getting used more efficiently, so the gas tax doesn't pay for it. People have been arguing variously for an increase in the gas tax, some kind of user fees for cars, other ways to raise revenue outside of borrowing. Does there appear to be any kind of increasing appetite for doing one of those things in the legislature?
It does not appear that they're going to really take on that issue until the next budget. And again, you know, they've struggled with this for the last several budgets. It's always debated to some extent. It's really starting to come to a point where, there are immediate effects, at least in the world of state politics, on these decisions. You know, this is the first time where, after the legislature made a decision, these kinds of delays were announced. So they are at a crucial point where they have to decide that they're going to find more money for roads, or they're going to slow down the initial plans, and find that the orange barrels would be up for longer. It's a debate that's going to go on, and who knows how it'll go, but we probably won't really have lawmakers debating that issue again until after the next election in a year and a half or so.
And briefly, in Wisconsin's survey results out today, 44% of people said they'd prefer raising fees like gas tax or registration fees. 29% said, yeah, they're okay with borrowing money. Everyone else, this is a big chunk of people, said neither, other, or not sure. So we're not going to see a long-term fix anytime soon, it sounds like.
Well, although politicians and people in state government are aware that these things are coming, sort of rising to the top as concerns, drivers aren't necessarily noticing anything and probably wouldn't notice anything until things got much worse. It's, nobody's eager to raise their taxes. And, if a road takes a couple more years, and especially if it's not in your area, you might not really consider that a problem. So politicians, if they do decide to go down the try to raise more money for roads, they're going to have to go out there and persuade the public that it's something that's needed.
Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the latest on proposed borrowing for roads here in Wisconsin. Celebrated comedian and panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone joins us now. She's got awards and honors and publications aplenty to her name. She's touring her stand-up act right now with a visit to Green Bay coming up this Saturday at the Meyer Theater.
Paula Poundstone is with us now. She's a comedian, actress, and panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Paula, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to coming to Wisconsin, and I want to tell people so you don't rush out to get me a gift. I already have a cheese scarf.
Okay, that is a top gift here in Wisconsin. I want to ask a little bit about what your shows are like. I hear that they're very improvisational. You're not someone who goes on stage with a set that is memorized word for word. You like to keep it loosey-goosey and respond to what's going on. Why does that feel more comfy to you?
Well, for one thing, because I have almost zero short-term memory, memorizing anything is just agonizing. And then, even when I think I have, I get nervous and half of it flies out of my head. And so, I don't know, many, many years ago, I've been doing this job for 36 years, and many, many years ago, it dawned on me that oftentimes the really fun part of the night was the part when I forgot what I was going to say. And so I began sort of allowing myself to do that. And, the freedom just sort of makes the night a lot more fun. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. And, it might remind me of some, story that I've told before, or else we just go in an entirely different direction. And, I don't know, seems to be working out okay.
And I know that you talk about screen addiction. Maybe it's not the funniest part of your night, you say, but it is something that's been a big issue. And you've got audiences now who have their screens there. There have been allegations in the comedy world of joke stealing. Do you ever call anybody out for being on their phone?
No, I don't think I ever have. People, every now and then I see a device here or there. The truth is, we're so addicted as a culture at this point that if people, you know, when they say turn your phone off, people can't. They have such anxiety about it that I'm not sure the show would be funny to people if they were forced really to put their thing away and turn their phone off. So, yeah, I can see the little, I can see it glowing here and there in the crowd, although I like to tell myself that I have most of their attention. It changes the brain, and in our children, it's actually causing brain damage. And so I think we have to take another course. People like to tell me it's not addiction, that they just enjoy using it. And I explain to them, look, I love to play ping pong. I love to tap dance. I love to practice the drums. I have never tried to do any one of those things while driving in such a way that the cops couldn't see. Because those are things I enjoy. They are not things I am addicted to.
Well, I was looking over everything that you've done over the years. You've got a lot of firsts there, you know, especially for women. You were the first woman to perform stand-up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, first woman to win the Cable Ace for Best Comedy Special. I wonder how you feel about that. Obviously, it's great for women comics, but how do you feel about having, you know, this association with being a female comic? Are you ready to be done with it, or are you mostly just proud of it?
Well, you know, the smaller you make the pool, the better your opportunity at being a big fish in it. And so if I, you know, if we narrowed it to, you know, women with dark hair, I would have even more accolades, you know. And if we narrowed it to, you know, women who do stand up and take tap dance on the side, I would kill. I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think the whole male-female comedy thing, yes, does to some degree sort of ghettoize women comics, but part of the, and by the way, I've participated in it in as many times as I have damned it. If somebody's making a documentary about women in comedy and I wasn't included, I guess I would feel bad about that. But at the same time, it is a genderless job. Funny is funny. It's fun to go out and laugh. Not only is it fun to go out and laugh, but it's mentally healthy to go out and laugh. It is, you know, scientifically sound. It's this really cool thing that nature, for whatever reason, has given us. It's healing. It reduces pain. And that thing of not, you know, of not being at home watching stuff on YouTube or even television or DVD, but being out with the group and being caught up in that wave of laughter is like no other experience. So I figure, you know, the more things you're willing to laugh at, the healthier you have the possibility of being.
And that may be one reason why Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a hit with audiences. This is the NPR game show. How different is what you do there from, say, your stand-up act?
Well, I don't answer any questions about the week's news in my stand-up act, which sometimes I think, you know, I have a lot of audience members that come to see me because they're familiar with me from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I think a lot of times they're surprised that I'm not answering questions about the week's news. And I probably have just as many fans that come to see me because they've been longtime fans of my stand-up comedy and they've never heard of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and they can never figure out what people are talking about when it comes up. But the similarity between the two, actually, and part of the reason why Wait, Wait is such a great fit for me and such a wonderful opportunity for me, is that they allow not just me, but all of us panelists, they encourage us to say whatever we want whenever we want to say it. And so it's really a free-for-all. It's a joyful free-for-all. Oftentimes with topics that are sometimes of a more serious nature. I mean, sometimes, you know, people make me nervous when they say stuff like, that's how I get my news. I'm like, oh, don't do that. You know, listen to Morning Edition, throw on, you know, the PBS NewsHour, maybe some BBC. Don't get your news from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Do you have any funny stories from behind the scenes or maybe on the scenes, favorite moments in the show?
I love doing this. I love doing this show. I was riding in a cab one time, and, you know, cab drivers listen to the radio, and so I don't know. I said something to the guy. He recognized my voice, and it happened to be a weekend day. And he said, "Oh, I just listened to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me," and they had Bill Clinton on, and I was so pissed when I heard this. So I go to Peter, my boss, and the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and I'm known for being somewhat verbose. Unfortunately, it's not on purpose. I just am. And I said, "Peter, how could you have Bill Clinton on without me?" And he said, "Paul, if we had you and Bill Clinton on at the same time, we'd still be recording."
A missed opportunity, but
I'm pleased that Bill Clinton and I have a similar challenge. They said that he was very lengthy, and I think he answered questions. I'm not positive about this, but either about My Little Pony or Smurfs.
Wow, I'm going to have to listen back to that. Presidential advice about the Smurfs is hard to come by these days. Well, Paula, you're going to be in Green Bay. You're going to be in where else? Red Wing, Minnesota?
I am going to be in Red Wing, Minnesota. Both places I've been before, and I'm delighted to go back to.
Well, great. We look forward to having you, and hope you have a fabulous time in those places. And people are going to enjoy seeing you new material, or just going to see what happens?
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both. All right. Well, sounds good, Paula. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Veronica. It was nice talking with you.
That's Paula Poundstone, comedian, author, actress, and, of course, she's a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And she's going to be coming to Green Bay this Saturday for a performance at the city's Meyer Theater.
When I listen to Wait, Wait, sometimes I think, wow, it would be a lot of fun to do a show like that. And then I think it would also be terrifying to do a show like that with all these really funny people spontaneously react to these things. And you'd be worried you'd be the guy there. You guys go ahead.
Get the cane. Rob Ferret's on board.
Stick around. More to come. Wisconsin Life continues this month's exploration of faith in Wisconsin. For three generations, one Milwaukee family has been providing church supplies to Christian congregations throughout the United States.
Oh, wow. Oh, have you been in here yet?
No.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
So, statuary.
Just for radio, we're standing in front of, I don't know, 100 different statues of
Joseph, patron saints, nativity sets, angels. That particular corpus of Christ is 6 feet tall. It's made of plaster, has glass eyes. I have a piece upstairs that's 8 feet tall, made of copper. But this collection of statuary probably dates back anywhere from the late 1800s through the 1950s. I am Dan Stemper, and I'm the president at the T.H. Stemper Company here in Milwaukee. We're a small niche market business, and we sell church supplies and furnishings and apparel to Christian denomination churches. The history of our business goes back to 1911. My grandfather purchased a business called the European Statuary and Art Company, and it was at the same site in Bayview. I come from a family of eight, so all eight of us at one time have worked here. Five of the brothers are equal owners of this business today. We have approximately 40,000 square feet of usable space. I'm kind of the bean counter in the family. So I probably, in inventory, I have anywhere from $600,000 to $800,000 invested in inventory at any given day. Candles are the number one product line. We have 1,100 different candles. Communion trays, the offering plates, the common cups, the intinction sets, the ciborias, the flagons, cruets, and candlesticks and bells and altar crucifixes, altar crosses. It's just a never-ending supply. The other thing that we sell is we do a lot of restoration. We sell chalices new, we restore old. We sell new tabernacles, we can restore the old. Anything made of brass or bronze can pretty much be restored. The items, which are considered sacred vessels, they're delicate. They're expensive. They're not mass-produced. One of our goals is to take these sacred vessels and put them back into use for what they were originally intended. Yes, I'm a for-profit business. I have 14 employees, and I want to make sure that we can survive and they can retire and they can count on us every morning when we open the door. But I also like the people that are my customers, and it certainly makes the job more fulfilling. I find that it definitely enhances my faith life. I'm Catholic. I'm born and raised Catholic. I think that I'm doing a service to the church.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more info online at wisconsinlife.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest news on election-related bills debated today in the Wisconsin State Assembly.
First, tipping has become an accepted part of life here in the United States and a topic that's often passionately debated, as we'll hear in this scene from the film Reservoir Dogs, edited just enough so that we can play it on the air.
All right. I'll take care of the check. You guys can get the tip.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
Let me just get this straight. You don't ever tip, huh?
I don't tip because society says I have to. All right, I mean, I'll tip if somebody really deserves a tip. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. But, I mean, it's tipping automatically. It's for the birds. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're just doing their job.
This is a hard job.
So is working at McDonald's, but you don't feel the need to tip them, do you?
Last week, a large New York City restaurant group announced it'll be eliminating tipping in all 13 of its restaurants to help even the pay among servers and back of house, the kitchen, restaurant staff. Joining us now to talk about the past, present, and future of tipping is New York Times restaurant critic Pete Wells. Pete, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, talk about this new model of charging at restaurants that this restaurateur is talking about here.
Well, this is the Union Square Hospitality Group in New York. With their CEO is Danny Meyer, and they've got some of the best known and I think best loved restaurants in the city, including Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern and The Modern. And I think the group is 13 restaurants in total. And they have announced that they're going to eliminate tipping at all of them by the end of next year, starting with The Modern in about a month. And the way they're going to do it is by raising prices. So the servers, if it all works out, will be making roughly what they make now, maybe more if all goes really, really well. And customers will be looking at higher prices on the menu.
And this is something that I think a lot of people have been thinking about for a while, but are maybe restaurant owners afraid to take the plunge. The question is, if you bump up those prices to account for the tips that aren't there, does that scare people away? Is that something that has a lot of people worried?
I think that's a big concern. I heard that from restaurateurs who are adamant that they won't do this, that they can't do it, because the psychological effect of seeing higher menu prices is more powerful than the, you know, intellectual calculation that you make that says, well, I'm going to be tipping on top of that menu price anyway, so it kind of works out to more or less the same. And it doesn't quite work out to be the same, because I think the bottom line for people, if you get the exact same thing, is going to be higher because of some tax oddities. You know, we don't pay tax on tips, but you're going to pay a full tax on the higher menu price.
And one point that's been raised here is something that probably the average restaurant goer, I'll say I, didn't know about, that the whole tip situation is sometimes seen as an inequality between the people we see, the servers who get tips, and the people working behind the scenes who don't get the tips.
That's become a growing divide over the past 10, 20, 30 years. If you think back 20, 30 years ago, when I was a kid and a young man, 15% tip was standard. And then you started hearing 17%. And now in New York, at least, I think most people feel that 20 is the standard. So tips have gone up and up and up. And at the same time, food prices and menu prices have gone way up. So I think, if I may, I may have this slightly wrong, but not too far off. I think that Danny Meyer told me that his what the take home of the average server is has gone up in the time he's been in the business something like 200-300%, and you know, I don't think too many other people can say that, and certainly the people in the kitchen are not seeing anything like that kind of a pay increase. So there's because we have this culture of tipping, we've created a strange imbalance in how people in the restaurant business are compensated. That is not what, not necessarily what the managers and owners would choose if they were just to sit down and set wages the way you do in most companies by supply and demand in the labor pool and wanting to compensate your most valuable people and give them promotions and so forth. So the think of most any other business, prices are roughly competitive with other people doing the same thing. Wages are roughly competitive, and that is not the case anymore in the restaurant business.
We're talking to Pete Wells, New York Times restaurant critic. We're talking about tipping as one major restaurant group in New York says, hey, we're getting rid of tipping starting over the next couple of months in all of our restaurants. This has been a debate, a question around the country. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Would you rather have restaurants without tipping? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Pete, one argument that sometimes restaurant customers make for our current system for tipping is it's a motivator to get good service from waitstaff. So without tipping, do you think we would notice a change in the quality of service?
Well, I can tell you that I've been going to some restaurants here that have eliminated tipping in the past couple of years, and I've been getting very good service. So it hasn't been my experience. Then again, it's only a limited number of places. I certainly think it's a motivator for service staff. Beyond question, they've got that in mind all the time, and it probably helps. On the other hand, it can also help with things that you don't want, like upselling. Suggesting the special that's $5, $6, $10 more than everything else on the printed menu. Suggesting I ask about a bottle of wine, and the sommelier says, that's okay. That's an okay bottle, but I've got something really good over here, and it happens to be $90, but it's really, really worth it. All of those things that you bump up the check a little bit more than you'd expect. And, I think a good server, a conscientious server doesn't do that, and a conscientious restaurant doesn't really want their servers doing that. But, boy, there's absolutely a built-in motivation to do that.
One criticism of a tipping system, having the customers, in effect, pay the employee more than the owner, is that this is mostly a female profession in many restaurants around the country, and it exposes that mostly female staff to harassment, maybe from customers, maybe from coworkers, that they have to put up with in hopes of getting that tip that they rely on.
Well, boy, that opens up a whole line of kind of strange behavioral problems in tipping. We've got studies that show that younger servers get higher tips, that more attractive servers get higher tips, that whites get higher tips than blacks. It goes on and on, and it's a kind of disparity in compensation that we have laws against for regular wages, but it happens in tipping.
We'll go to a caller. We've got Kevin on the line at 800-642-1234. Kevin joins us from Milwaukee. Kevin, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me to talk. I used to be a restaurant manager. My wife is currently a restaurant manager. We both served as well. I can see for a high-end restaurant, where you have a very professional level of service, where eliminating the tipping, you would still get the same level of service from your servers. But in a lot of the chain restaurants, a lot of the restaurants you'll see with most lower end, you're going to see a huge change in service because It's very hard to manage servers when you're not seeing them at the table unless you're getting responses back from the customers. So if you take away that tipping aspect, you're going to see a very big change in how they perform. And also, serving is a pretty stressful job if you're relying on your customers to give you a better tip versus working in the kitchen. You might get paid a bit less or a little less, but it's also consistent. So if it's a slow night versus a busy night, you're still going to make the same amount of money in the kitchen. So those were my comments.
Kevin, thanks for the call. So something he says that might work at higher-end restaurants, chain restaurants, lower-end places, maybe not, Pete.
I mean, you know, this will be a big experiment if lower-end restaurants even dare to take the experiment. I think he may be right. There is a chance that it will break out differently in high-end restaurants. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine it working at the local diner. You know, it is. On the other hand, if you think of, you know, your workplace or my workplace or the average workplace, you know, there are other ways to motivate workers than giving them a big pocket full of money at the end of the night. Although, boy, that is a very appealing one, right?
We're talking to Pete Wells, New York Times restaurant critic, talking about a recent no-tipping policy announced by a large New York City restaurant group.
And we're taking your calls now. How much do you usually tip for a meal? Do you think this no-tipping model is a good idea? Or maybe you weigh tables and you want to weigh in on this. Call in now with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with New York Times restaurant critic Pete Wells about a recent no-tipping policy announced by a large New York City restaurant group.
And we're taking your calls now. Would you support this no-tipping model for Wisconsin restaurants? Maybe you like to use tipping as a direct feedback for the kind of service you get at a restaurant, or do you work in that industry? What's your perspective? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Jeff is on the line in Onalaska. Jeff, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I would be in favor of getting rid of the tipping. I just think that it would be much more fair and would cut out the possibility of discrimination or, you know, just because I think right now a server could get treated unfairly if they're not as attractive as a different server, or if they're of a different race, or if they just get customers who are poor tippers because some people don't believe in tipping as much and they tip really poorly, which actually I think, you know, you could make the argument that, like, I know part of the argument for tipping is that it can create better service, but I think if the server gets a bad tipper, then they're probably going to be disgruntled and more likely to give poor service on their next few tables just because of, you know, being treated unfairly or getting a poor tip.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I imagine, Pete, that diners are pretty divided on this issue. Some agreeing with Jeff that this is going to be more fair if we get rid of tipping. Some still appreciate that feedback that comes from tipping.
I think that's true, and I think people are very, very used to it. And some of us, and I include myself here, just tip automatically, it's been shown that in fact most people leave the same tip everywhere they go, every time, unless something goes horrendously wrong. But there are some people who are very, very, very attached to the idea and don't want to give up the power to communicate with the tip. And in fact, it's often difficult to communicate verbally in a restaurant when you've had a bad experience. It can be intimidating for people to call over the manager and say, you know, we really had a problem at this table. And I think for those people, it's a little bit easier to just, you know, leave a smaller tip than they normally would to get that message across.
We've got a couple callers on the line, it looks like, who have worked in this line of work as servers at restaurants. I want to hear from both of them. Amy first with us in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I totally disagree with the last caller. I served all the way through college to make money. I currently serve on the weekends, even though I have, you know, a full-time job. But I think that it would be ridiculous to get rid of tipping and, you know, pay servers a straight wage because, you know, I could have five or six tables in my section and I'm running around, you know, and doing a great job, whereas the person next to me could have two tables they're waiting on and totally be out, you know, not really outgoing and not doing well with their tables, and we're getting paid the same rate. It's not fair. And I also don't really understand where your last caller was coming from when he says that servers become disgruntled if they, you know, get a bad tip or not tipped at all. Well, yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, the greatest thing, but we've got more tables. You just move on to the next one. It's the nature of the beast.
Amy,
if you're a server, you know that.
Amy, thanks a lot for that perspective. We'll go now to Sarah with us on the line in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hi. After just hearing that caller, I'm amazed. She's like the most optimistic server I've ever come in contact with. I served for years and years and finally just decided to give it up because it was truly very well. Never knew what I was going to come home with. And, you know, and it's like every table is like the lottery, right? So, like, you could give the best service to this table and they're not going to tip you because they don't believe in tipping or because it's not in their budget or... I mean, there's a million reasons why you may not get the tip that you earn.
All right, Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. So a point counterpoint from servers there, Pete. One says, hey, this is an opportunity to get lots of money. Great service will generally result in great tips. But Sarah then answers, no, it's a lottery. It's unreliable, unpredictable. So there's not agreement even among the people most directly affected here.
Oh yeah, and I think you're going to see that split among servers at every restaurant that tries this. There are some people for whom it works really, really well, and it's an opportunity to make the kind of money that's very hard to make anywhere else. And on the other hand, you'll have people who you know don't love the system, have been stiffed from time to time. Anybody who's worked in restaurants knows about coming in on a Monday night and there's a snowstorm and there's one table and you're standing around all night and at the end of the night you don't have that much to show for it. If what the Union Square Hospitality Group is trying to do works, it'll mean that on those slow nights you'll take home the same pay that you would on a busy night. But some servers may not like that. Some servers may really, really want the big paydays from the busy nights.
Talking to Pete Wells, New York Times restaurant critic, about tipping, some restaurants moving toward an end to the gratuity. Back to our callers now with Liz in Madison. Liz, hi.
Hi there. I agree with the gentleman from a couple of calls ago, and I think tipping is ridiculous. Everybody does a good job at their job if that's what they, you know, whatever job that they do, and I don't understand why, like, at restaurants or anywhere, we have to give a tip or should be expected to tip. I work a regular job during the week, and then I also bartend on weekends, and I get paid ridiculous amounts in tips from people sometimes. And while it's great and I appreciate it, I think to myself, I work a lot harder during my day job and I don't get a tip for that. And what? Same with lots of people. So my husband and I were in Europe this past summer. You don't have to tip at restaurants there at all. And people still do their job. They get paid a fair wage. They work hard. They smile at their tables. They run around. They have lots of tables. And I mean, everybody works hard at their job, and everybody should get paid just a regular, fair wage.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Pete, she brought up a lot there. The Europe question. I understand we originally started tipping in America to be sophisticated like Europe. Well, in the meantime, they stopped tipping, and now we still do it. Is there a European influence that might help end tipping here?
You know, every time I come close to saying, you know, they don't tip in Europe, somebody jumps on me and says, what do you mean they don't? Of course you have to leave a tip in Europe. So it's nuanced and it varies from, you know, country to country and even from you know, kind of establishment to, you know, so in a cafe you might leave the change from rounding up. and in a restaurant you might leave something more. But I, you know, I've never been any place where the tipping culture is as crazy as in this country, where it's a whole lot of money. Did you have a question about how
she brought up bartenders too? I wanted to ask about that. Is there talk about bringing bartenders under a no tip regime? Because I know a lot of bartenders, they're working for tips mainly.
Well, the bartenders in these restaurants will fall under this, yeah, and that will be interesting because any of these front of house servers at these restaurants will have the opportunity to go somewhere else and maybe make more money or make money in the way they like it, you know, in with a whole big wad on a Saturday night. So one of the things any restaurant jumping over to this has to worry about is people leaving and going to another restaurant or bar.
Well, talking about how this is going to play in the restaurant industry, is this a thing you think where people have been waiting for a big name to make this move and we're going to see lots of other restaurants follow? Or is it something where they're going to maybe watch how this works for, I don't know, a year or 2 years? Then maybe if it seems like it's working, then maybe we'll see a whole bunch of people follow suit.
I think both. I mean, this has been something that's been discussed more and more frequently and urgently in the past couple of years, and I've done a number of interviews about it. But people are nervous for all the reasons we've talked about, and they are going to be watching this restaurant group really closely to see how it works, if it works, and how they manage it. I mean, there's a trick to raising restaurant prices. I don't think anybody's just going to slap 25% on every single price. You think about, you know, there's some items that might be price sensitive, like, you know, your cheapest bottle of wine on the menu. The cheapest bottle of wine is sort of priced that way for a reason, because that's maybe what some customers are comfortable paying, and they don't want to pay a whole lot more than that. A bottle of beer at the bar, a cup of coffee, these are things that where people really have a sense of, like, well, coffee costs this, although, boy, I have paid some amazing prices for coffee recently. So it's going to have to be, a kind of sophisticated case-by-case approach to come up with something where customers are comfortable paying the extra prices and don't really feel the pinch on certain price-sensitive items.
We'll be watching this play out. I assume you will, too. Pete, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That was New York Times restaurant critic Pete Wells talking about a no-tipping policy recently enacted in a New York restaurant group. And you can keep sharing your thoughts. Would you like to see this happen closer to home? Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.